The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Good morning and welcome to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org and always available via podcast. You can find us on iTunes, we're on Amazon, we're on Stitcher, however you consume your podcasts. You can look for us under Writers on Writing. You can follow us on Facebook, Writers on Writing. You can follow us on Twitter, WOWKUCIFM. Barbara has a website, penonfire.com. Mine is mariestone.com, two R's in Marie. I'm your host for the hour, Marie Stone. We are doing what we do every Wednesday morning, which is chat with authors about their books, their process, their craft, their publishing experiences, whatever else comes up. I always love welcoming guests back and following their literary progression, and today is one of those days, along with one of those days when I get to chat about my favorite form, the short story form. Ethan Rutherford's fiction has appeared in Bomb, Tin House, Plowshares, One Story, American Short Fiction, The Best American Short Stories, and elsewhere. His first book, The Peripatetic Coffin and Other Stories, garnered all sorts of awards and attention. He was on the show with me in 2015 to talk about that collection. Ethan has his MFA in creative writing from the University of Minnesota and now teaches creative writing at Trinity College. His latest collection is Farthest South. It is published by A Strange Object, an imprint of Deep Vellum, and it will drive our chat this morning. Ethan, welcome back.
Hi, thank you. Thank you so much for having me back. This is fun.
So the last time we talked in 2015, which were such innocent and carefree days, weren't they?
I think it seems like it. Yeah,
right. So I think then you were writing a novel. So I'd love to kind of pick up where we left off, what happened with the novel and how the short story form reasserted itself, and thank God it did, because I just love this collection.
Wonderful. I'm glad you like the collection. It's great. So going back in the sort of time machine, which feels even further away now, 2015, that novel exploded on me. I felt like I really had a hold of it, and it just sort of slipped away from me. And I'm not entirely sure why. I think I may have been trying to sort of put too much, every thought that I've ever had about what a novel is and should be and could be, and, you know, address environmental cataclysm, et cetera. And it just kind of drifted away with the attendant sense of shame that I think happens with that, where you go, I've told everybody about this. Like, I was going to bring this novel to prom next year. I was really excited. But it wasn't clear to me at the time that it wasn't quite working. I just sort of felt like, I was like, well, I'm in the weeds. And around that time as well, my two children were very young, and we were just sort of in the kind of the fever dream of early childhood, you know, early parenthood. And I wasn't able to find, I've heard other writers talk about this with writing and parenting, where that one of the shocks and kind of the adjustments that you have to make as a parent is when you're writing something long, you want to submerge and stay down in the depths. And you kind of need to do that for an extended period of time to access the, I don't know, whatever it is you're looking for, whatever sort of sea creature you're trying to bring up to the surface. But when you're a parent, every day at a certain point, multiple times a day, you are constantly sort of coming up to the surface to try to be as present for them as possible. Mm-hmm. And so as that was happening, I just was like, hey, the novel's just, it's not working. I would sit down, I'd write a sentence, and then I'd have to go pick somebody up, or sort of the shimmering anxiety of being a parent of a young kid would just intrude. And so I just started writing short stories again as kind of a way of, I don't know, sort of trying to find my way back to putting a shape on a particular experience. And the experience that I was having at that time was that of a young parent. And that's just what I started writing about. And before I knew it, these stories were the stories where I was finding those moments of submergence. And so then with great relief, I just sort of said goodbye to that particular novel. I still have it on somewhere on the hard drive of shame somewhere. But it was so thrilling to start these stories again and actually be kind of writing about the stuff that I was constantly thinking about, which was, what does it mean to be a parent in the world, and what's your responsibility to your children? So that's how I returned to short stories. And I'm thrilled. And I'm in the middle now of writing another novel. My children are a little bit older and I get a little bit more time. And it's, and so I do get that sort of submerging feeling on this book that I'm working on. But so that's what happened to that old thing. I feel like I had everything. I had a title I was really excited about, but it's just what happens in listening to interviews like this with other writers. It was very calming to hear that that was sort of a pretty common experience.
Oh yeah. Well, first of all, I would say it's going to sound so mid-20th century ancient of me to say this, but it's so refreshing to hear a male writer say this, because I talk to so many older male writers where they all have children and none of this would have occurred to them, you know, and female writers that I talk to, this is all that occurs to them, right? They're like, well, you got to juggle these 18 things. So if there's any hope at all, it's that society is moving in a direction where parenting is a multi, you know, a bi-gender concern for writers. And so that's nice. I also wonder if there's just like, do you feel like there's a center of gravity for writers between the some writers are essentially novelists and some writers are essentially short story writers? Because I've just been thinking about the architecture of the two is so vastly different. And you never meet an architect who's a commercial architect who's also a residential architect, right? I mean, they're usually two different things. Yeah. And I wonder if there's any parallel there between how the mind works in constructing stories on a vast landscape versus, you know, a more, and I wouldn't even call it a constricted landscape, because I feel like short stories are just as vast. They're just, you know, the difference between building an apartment building versus building a mansion.
Yeah, no, I think that's great. It's really wonderful to imagine like Zaha Hadid redesigning someone's kitchen, like in her spare, you know, you're just right, like, well, right. You're really great at this other thing over here. I think so. And to pivot back just like a little bit, I mean, I'm with you, like I'm reading these biographies of, you know, and you get to page like 467 of these biographies of these male writers and you go like, wait a minute, you had six kids? Like it wasn't even part of your life? Like what, how did that happen? I mean, the great pleasure of my sort of recent life has been being sort of involved with my kids. And I feel really lucky that to also find a way to write about it. As for kind of your constitution as a writer, I mean, I think it's true. I'm really enjoying, one of the things that I am enjoying though, even if the novel doesn't come through, is that sense of staying with a project for a long time. But I do think that writers generally are sort of those, you either like really kicking the carpet out in front of you and just drafting, and you pay a lot of attention to 3-act structure, et cetera, and you can kind of juggle all these things in your head, and then you're a novelist. And as a short story writer, I just find that I'm so much more interested in sentence level things and kind of really quick veers and what you can do with the architecture of a short story. I mean, they're more like little Swiss clocks. Mm-hmm. I mean, every piece has to kind of snap into it. And I think that if you have the personality that's a little bit of a perfectionist, you just kind of can't quite let things go. I enjoy just moving sentences around. I love moving sentences around. My wife's also a writer and she kicks the carpet out. And for a while we were doing a shared, like a work document where we would just report on how many words we did. And I just had to stop. I was like, I would get like 47 words in 6 hours. And she'd be like, man, she's like, I almost hit 6,000 today. Like, I think tomorrow I can really, and you just go, okay, we're just different people, you know? So yeah, I love the short story and I love working in the short story. I also kind of would love to be released from the short story for a little bit, because I mean, you think about them as much as I could imagine sort of thinking about a novel. I mean, these short stories, just because they're short, it doesn't, you sort of go, well, how did it take me a year to write this thing that's 20 pages? And there's a world where you sort of say that amount of labor then did come and produce a doorstop, but it's just not how I'm working right now.
Well, I remember the last time you were on, we geeked out for like 5 minutes of our short conversation on a comma placement in one of the title stories. So I'm with you. I mean, I definitely understand the inclination to, I love the analogy of the Swiss clock. That feels exactly right. So I was thinking about the comparison of the apartment building versus the house, you know, mansion. The short story has to recreate 28 different kitchens as opposed to the novel, which has the one central kitchen. And yet they all have to work together. You know, you can't just have, you know, they still have to coalesce into a single building. You can't have random 9 or 10 completely random short stories. I mean, they really have to be in conversation with each other for them to make sense. So, I mean, when somebody says this story took me a year, I'm like, it only took a year? That's pretty, well, you were kind of cooking with gas there.
You know? I know. Yeah, what are you, Stephen King? So what you're talking about of short stories actually forming the rooms of a house, I really love that. And I think that that's true. And one of the things then you kind of are wondering, you go, you're thinking about doorways and portals from one story into the next and making sure that that is all sort of like lined up as well. And I like that stuff. When I played in a band, my favorite part of playing, besides playing live, but was thinking about the order of songs on an album. Like, what does the first track prepare you to do on for the second track? And then how do you kind of discharge this melody line that was kind of established in the first song or story? What does it mean when that then kind of comes back and is discharged again on the seventh track? And I like thinking about things in that way.
And you can tell in these stories, we'll get into them in detail, but there are so many places where you'll have a story that's really very different than another story, but you know, there'll be little figurines and dolls, or there'll be a ghost, or there'll be that, just these little touchstones that tell you, yeah, this is linked to that, or my brain gets pleasure from remembering this from this other story that was in a totally different context. But also you can tell that they're in conversation with each other. And I just think that's one of the real pleasures of short story collections. So why don't you introduce it and talk a little bit about what was on your mind, maybe in relation to the peripatetic coffin? You know, if there are some themes that, you know, water and expeditions and boating continued on as themes, but you've also moved on into a different realm in these stories as well. So maybe you can just kind of set the foundation for the book, and then we can jump off and talk in further detail.
Absolutely. So, I mean, I think that the interesting thing that has happened between the writing of these two books is simply that when I was writing the stories for that became the Peripatetic Coffin, I wasn't a parent, I was a child, and that was my relationship to the world. And the stories that appear here are all stories that I wrote as a parent. And when I look back at the stories in the Peripatetic Coffin, the animating question for a lot of those stories, like, and this is really how I used to write stories, is I would always say, all right, here we are at a moment. What's the worst thing that could possibly happen to my characters at this time? But once I had kids, that question was, I just didn't feel like touching it anymore. I didn't feel like it was productive. In the stories that I started to find myself writing, it had to do with finding ways to put a container around the kind of difficulty of the world, right? And to at least, at the very least, if you're going to move into these sort of darker zones, that there's also a tenderness pushing back against that. And I think that that is one of the things that produced, I mean, what, there are three stories in Farthest South that use a frame. They're frame stories. And it's that sort of formal device where someone is telling a story and then the story begins to kind of take over. And the only way that I can sort of say is that I was trying to take these stories to reflect what my experience was of being a young parent, which was, we sort of talked about a little bit of that sort of that surface submergence, surface submergence, surface submergence kind of whiplash that happens. But also that sense of the responsibility that you have as a parent, where you sort of say, okay, I need to tell you about the world and prepare you for the world, but I also need to kind of protect you from the world in some ways. And so the frame stories started appearing when the stories wanted to go to the sort of a darker place. And then you go, but layered on top of all of this, there's also sort of a tenderness. I'm going to take care of you as we're kind of experiencing this together. So I would say that that's probably the biggest, that's absolutely the biggest change between these two books. And then I think as a writer, I mean, you're a writer and you've talked to, you know, tons of writers. You kind of have these emotional places or images that just, no matter what you do, they just kind of keep recurring in your work. Mm-hmm. And for me, it's water. And I think that it's oceans and boats. It has to do with how I grew up and where I sort of started thinking about all of these things. And one of the things that I've always been interested in, I think this carries through in all the stories, is that sense of loneliness and isolation, even when in a crowd and or in sort of a family unit, and the ways in which those two states of being are kind of in tension. And being on a boat gives that an image in a real place for me.
I forget how, I don't think we talked about this before, but your growing up and decision to become a writer, like if writing was always a part of, we were talking offline about both spending time in Seattle and that framework as it in your childhood with kind of the oppressive weather combined with looking out to the sea, and the sea is not a Hawaiian sea. It's a very tumultuous, you know, often, yeah. latency, right? And so tell me a little bit about, like, because I talk to a ton of writers who say the emotional stuff that they keep returning to is seated in their childhood. Those are the images that they keep going back to, even if they're overlaying it with this new experience of parenthood. And so I'm wondering, you know, if you feel like that stuff came from the Pacific Northwest, came from Seattle and how you grew up, and, you know, if you grew up knowing you were going to be a writer from the early stages.
One of the things that also happens, or at least happened to me as a parent, is that you, when you start thinking about how you want to be as a parent, you start thinking about, you know, what your experience sort of growing up was. And that starts to kind of shimmer and kind of radiate and form the work that you do. I think that that's entirely true. I mean, you're talking about the Pacific Ocean when you're in the Pacific Northwest and you go like, yeah, it's pretty, but that ocean is, it's not messing around. And pretty quickly you can get into trouble. And that is something that I feel must have just lodged when I was a kid. And, you know, there's a lot of rainy days. You sit inside, you read a lot. And I used to go sailing when I was a kid. We had a boat, and that's what our family would do in this really sort of enclosed space. And that's where I became a reader. There's nothing to do when it's raining and you're down below. And so your imagination can just sort of go and go wild. As for always wanting to be a writer, I was thinking about this. I don't know. I mean, it's definitely not true. It just sort of was that I always wanted to do something. I wanted to write comic books. I wanted to be a musician for a long time. And I was like, oh, I know I'm going to be a filmmaker. And it just turns out that I'm not great at collaboration or something. So I ended up writing fiction. I just loved reading. I found a lot of comfort in reading as a kid. So when it came time to think about how I wanted to spend my time, I was just trying to kind of recreate that experience, I guess.
So many of these stories are fabulistic. One is even called fable. But as you are talking about these being framed stories, Ghost Story and The Diver at the End are the two stories that sort of frame the collection. This feels like the right time in the world to return maybe to fables. You know, the world just seems so bizarre. And I assume a lot of these stories were written over the last four tumultuous years that our country was going through. And as I was reading them, I was like, this is just the perfect time to kind of revisit some of these old grim fairy tale kind of stuff from my own childhood and try and make sense of a completely senseless place through the device of the fable. Maybe device isn't the right word. And I was wondering, because I can't remember in Peripatetic Coffin if it was quite so fabulistic, magical, realistic, but this feels like the right collection for the time. And I was wondering if you had that same thought, or if, you know, kind of how the fable aspect of these stories came to be.
That's a great question. I think that the opening story, Ghost Story, and the closing story, The Diver, the frame is a father named Soren telling his kids stories. And when you're a kid, as you were sort of saying, those fables are really accessible to you and you do read them. I think there were a couple of things going on. The first thing that you mentioned is, I think you're exactly right. There's something that our sense of reality has kind of become skewed. You sort of, and I think that over the last 4 years, you would go, oh, everything's fine. And then you would like take a left, you'd be like, and that's a portal to hell. And that's fairy tale language, right? You take a bite of an apple and someone turns into a wolf or something like that. That there's some, it's hard to kind of connect the cause and effect. And when you operate in those modes, you can replicate that experience of your life on the page. And so I think that we've been seeing this in a lot of the stories that I've been reading. A lot of writers are working in this way now, that suddenly you just go like, whatever framework we had to, that we were trying to use to describe the world, doesn't quite seem to be putting a container on the strangeness or the sense of that there's just things that are lurking, like just out of view. And it's been a real pleasure to see writers move through those portals. For me, part of it became this challenge where, and I don't mean to sort of, I mean, I think this is really a book about young parenthood, but you just, your life is so repetitive in some way, so strange and so surface oriented. You kind of go like, what else do I have here? And then it's sort of a flat line trying to sort of take care of other people. And then, but your imagination is still working, but it's your imagination that allows you to leave the room. So when you have little kids who are sleeping and you sort of need to stay close to that room, you can't really go anywhere or sort of do anything, but your imagination can. And that was kind of the mode that I think gave birth to both of those stories, where you go like, we're stuck in this room, it's time to go to bed, but that doesn't mean we can't go anywhere and think our way into the world and try to imagine our way into the world. So that's where those came from. And then there's also, so Ghost Story, which is the first story in there. I don't know if you guys read the Frog and Toad stories, but yes. One of the great pleasures for me has been going back to all the stories that I really loved when I was a kid and trying to show them to my kids. And they go, that's really boring, Dad. They're like, oh, that's a good one. And there's this Frog and Toad story that I didn't remember called Shivers. And it's a story where Frog is just trying really hard. They essentially are just sitting near the fire. He says to Toad, he's like, have you ever had the shivers? He's like, and Toad's like, what is that? He's like, well, I'm going to tell you a scary story to sort of give you that kind of moment. And I just really liked, and the story is way scarier than I would have ever imagined, the story that Frog tells. And he tells a memory from when he was a kid. And at the end of it, Toad goes, did that really happen? He goes, maybe it did, maybe it didn't. I love that story, and my kids really responded to it. And that was kind of the birth of the kids go, tell us a scary story. And the story then kind of starts to slip its boundary a little bit. In other words, you're staying on the surface. You go down into the depth and try to sort of, in an attempt to kind of scare somebody. And then you come back up to the surface and then down into the depth and up into the surface with these interruptions and then down into the depths. And then kind of before you know it, the story itself breaks its bonds and kind of starts to move out and exert pressure on the present frame.
Yeah, I mean, it also strikes me as, it's hard to read anything without the lens through which the time period you're reading it. And so I was reading a lot of these stories through a pandemic lens. And your kids were obviously born way after mine, but, you know, our daughter was born right after 9/11. And so, you know, as a young parent, you're kind of like, what did I do? What did I bring them into? And so, yes, it's a way of showing them the world and protecting them from it at the same time. And so many of these stories I read through this pandemic lens of, oh yeah, this is a pandemic story. I mean, obviously none of these were written during the pandemic because they were written a while ago, but it's so specific that it felt universal to a lot of the experiences that I think we all have found ourselves in. You know, the title story, Farthest South, is this expedition across the ice. And I'm like, oh yeah, the isolation of the pandemic. And then you know, the diver story, I'm like, oh yeah, we're submerged, like it's climate change and the pandemic. So yeah, it's, you know, as I'm thinking about just how to grapple with the world. And as you said earlier, you know, that whatever framework we'd put around things doesn't make sense anymore. And so now we have to go into these kind of fantastical worlds to understand what's happened to us and come up with kind of a new language for what we're going through. Felt exactly right. Just these fears of, you know, parenthood is terrifying enough, but to overlay it with, oh my God, what world did we bring these kids into and what's going to happen to them as a result of it is, you know, another added layer, I think, of terror. There was a story in here, I think it was actually called Fable, which was another one of those frame stories. I think it was that one where she's telling a story. The teller of the fable says, you know, this is not a children's story. And that's kind of how these felt. You know, these are not children's stories, really.
Oh, yeah. No, I don't want to mislead people, have them sort of go out and be like, oh, this is a great kids book. It's not at all. And I think in some ways, one of the pleasures was pulling from the structures and infusing them with those, what you're talking about, sort of those very real concerns and that just kind of thrumming anxiety that you do have with sort of, you know, we're bringing the world to an end. What does it mean to then try to actually bring somebody into that? And so they do, like, these are stories about, because somebody called them the bedtime stories for the end of the world. And I was like, oh, that's a nice, you put that up in Times Square. But it also is about climate change and it's about trauma. And it's also about, I think, the selfishness. I mean, so Fable in particular, the story that you're talking about, it's, to me, it's sort of a story that is taking to task some of the selfishness and the strange desires that you have as a parent. And the person who's telling the story is essentially kind of taking these two parents to task for their sense of contentedness in the world by telling them this particular story.
So it sounds like parenthood really kind of changed your approach to writing or changed your areas of concern of writing. Did you feel that the external world sort of intruded on your interest in some of these topics more than, like, when we were writing The Peripatetic Coffin, did you feel like the exterior world was as much a thing to be commented upon as this collection was? Does that make sense?
It does make sense. And I'm trying to sort of think about it. With The Peripatetic Coffin, which is the book that I'm really proud of, I think that a lot of the stories in there, I was sort of just going like, what if I spin this plate? What if I spin that plate? Just essentially trying to keep myself and the reader interested. But there wasn't that much sort of attention to the idea of care in that collection. In terms of what you're talking about is like intrusion. And this is all the stories. Actually, I was thinking about this when I was talking to my students, and we were talking about how stories begin, and stories always begin with an interruption of some kind. And that also feels very true to me these last 4 years. There's always an interruption. And it felt very difficult to achieve that sort of state of where you could kind of concentrate on one thing or another. And so the world did intrude. And I think that the concerns that I have now as a parent have absolutely shifted. And it has less, I think that the stories in the Peripatetic Coffin were really interested in what, you know, the characters in those stories were more interested maybe in what other people did wrong. These stories are much more interested in what the characters themselves would hold themselves accountable for, where they think that they are responsible for causing harm or tending to people.
Well, let's take a couple of these, if you don't mind, and kind of really pick them apart as a kind of writing crafty lesson. And maybe it does make sense to start with the two framing stories, which is Ghost Story, which is the first story in the collection, and The Diver, which is the last, because they're dealing with the same set of characters. They do this framing device where the father is telling these kids a story. But there's also a lot going on in the marriage outside of what's going on between father and son and what the fable is he's telling. And I was really interested in, somebody recently said on the show, if your story isn't about 12 different things, you're doing something wrong. It's got to be about a bunch of stuff. And every story, mm-hmm. I was like, damn, this is about a bunch of things. So maybe mm-hmm. we start with Ghost Story. Talk a little bit about very first kernel, the screen is blank, the cursor is blinking, and that very first draft, and then how you came to understand what the story really was about and how you massaged it and, you know, transformed it into what it eventually became.
Yes, that's great. This will be fun. It's fun to sort of move through stories in this way. So quickly, the one thing that you did say was that, I don't know who the writer was who mentioned that, but I think that's entirely true, is that the successful stories, the way that they kind of achieve depth is by the sense that you go like outside of the frame here, there actually is a lot going on. And there are all sorts of complex relationships. But what we're looking at here is right here in this one particular instance. And by looking at this particular instance, then you can kind of get a sense of what the other tensions and pressures are that are kind of informing what's happening on page. For example, all of these stories, while they're very focused on what is being told between parents and children, they're also that sense of like the tension that really is informing a lot of them is the tension that like all young parents feel, which is like, are we going to make it through this? Like, what have we done? Every story I think of young parenthood is to some degree like a divorce story where you go like, is this going to be it? Or is this going to sort of work out? Which isn't to say that that's the only thing that the story is about, but that is one of the pressures that I think that's sort of moving through a lot of the stories in these collections. You're like, I want to hold this together, but it's not an easy thing to do. Is storytelling a way? How do we tell the stories about our family as well as sort of about the world? So with Ghost Story was the first story that really felt like a breakthrough. I'd gotten 3 weeks to go away, begged and bartered for 3 weeks to go away to write and work. And it was when the novel was falling apart. And I just sat down and I was like, I just have to make use of these 3 weeks. I had about 4 days of just disaster. I was actually trying to draft the story that became Farther South. And it just wasn't working and wasn't working. It wasn't working. And I just started to realize that if you aren't having fun while you're writing, or if you're not entertaining yourself and you're not kind of speaking to your own concerns, like what's the point? I just started writing about what it was I was doing, which was thinking about my kids. I spent a lot of time telling them stories. I put them to bed. And then the trick of this particular story became like, okay, how do you then make it interesting to somebody kind of outside of the family? And as I was writing it, I remember feeling, I was like, oh, if you set it up like this, where someone is telling a story to somebody else, the story can then slip and move anywhere you want it to go because it's a story simply that somebody is telling. It's a memory. It can be fantastical. I mean, it really can do anything. And once I kind of realized that, I felt like I had a way to write about the experience that I was feeling, which was a sort of intense pressure and the tension between staying on the surface and trying to find the depth, if that makes sense.
My guest this morning is Ethan Rutherford. The book is Farthest South, A Collection of Stories. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. The other thing this story seemed to do so well, and why I thought it was really well positioned at the beginning, is that it set up so many themes and so many images that you encounter throughout the rest of the book. I don't want to give too much away, but there's this seal lady, and he is meant to get these figurines. And that image repeats itself. I mean, there are seals throughout other stories, not all of them, some of them. There are figurines throughout a lot of these stories, little totems, little poppins, little figurines that make their appearance. As you say, this frame, you know, the way to tell a frame story appears in other stories. The father-son relationship appears in a lot of these stories, and this marriage concern, what is happening between the couple themselves, appears in yet other stories. And so it became one of those wonderful touchstones that you could then refer back to in every other story you read and say, I see elements of this here and here and here. I don't know if that was intentional or if that was just one of those lovely subconscious things that happens during the writing process that you're like, well, that paid off.
Yeah. Like, all right, this is what you would call like a happy accident where you just go, oh, okay, this is here. And then you're reaching for something else and you kind of do this. You reach back and sort of pull an object into another story. And I really like that. But you don't want to lean onto it too hard. You want to be like, oh, this guy really likes benches, right?
No, exactly.
And the thing with ghost stories, it was just the first story that I had that was just fun to write. It was just fun. There was no pressure. For the first time, a story just kind of flew out of me. And part of it was because when things started to fly off the handle a little bit, when the father is telling the story to his kids and he's saying, oh, this happened to me when I was younger. And then it was this seal lady and it was sort of this terrifying thing. You can break and go back. And then the kids start commenting on it. And then that is sort of a refresher and allows him to kind of comment and regroup and then go back in and kind of rethink the story itself. So it was just fun to write that story. And then part of the fun when you're telling it and be like, oh, I've never been able to write a story like this before where there are rules. Like the ticking clock on this is like what you're talking about is like, there's a story that is being told and it's going to finish. But then there's also that kind of fairy tale stuff of like, you must do these three things and then you shall be released from danger. And it was just fun to kind of move that story in that particular way.
You are the latter day Grimm of the Grimm's fairy tales. I went back and revisited those. They're terrifying.
They're awful. And I think it's not like funny, but one of the things I actually think that these stories are actually quite funny because you go like, this guy is like terrifying these children, like without thinking about it, like he's become so kind of submerged in the story that he's not really thinking about putting up the guardrails to a certain extent, right? He's in one way or another. And it does remind me of those Grimm stories where I went back to read some of them with my kids. And I was like, you know what? Actually, like, we don't need to read about some, you know, everyone's getting their hands chopped off. Let's do something else.
They are. They're uncommonly violent. Did you ever read the Ron Rash story? I think it's called Not Waving But Drowning. There was an image in there that was so similar to the diver, which, and I think it's just so lovely. I just think this water imagery is fantastic and says so much about not only about climate change, which a lot of what this story was, but just it's a wonderful metaphor. But he's in this boat and they have allowed this city to be completely submerged in water. And he can look down and there's an entire city down there of, you know, and the people are still down there and their houses and their crops and everything. And they're looking up and not waving, but drowning. And I was wondering if any of that part kind of informed the diver story, because.
No, that is so cool. I love that title also. No, I haven't read it, but that is so cool. And that's exactly the image that I was trying to evoke with that particular story. And we talked about the novel that exploded earlier, which was sort of about climate change and anxiety and how, what are you going to do about it? And that just sort of discharged into this particular story where the earth is suddenly filled with water. Now, what do you do? How do you make a life with what you've done? And then the imagery just really presents itself pretty clearly.
We should mention, if people haven't had a chance to pick up the book yet, the stories are punctuated with these amazing illustrations. And I haven't seen a collection with, you know, kind of an illustrated collection in recent days. And it's perfect for the stories because their fabulistic quality that harkens back to, as you say, it's children's literature for grown-ups with grown-up concerns and with grown-up imagery with these pictures. And so I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how the illustrations came to be. They almost seemed like, as you said, I think in another interview, it felt like you were writing to the images instead of the images being drawn for the stories, but they were so perfect for the book.
There are a few things. So Anders Nilsson is the guy who illustrated who sent in the illustrations. He writes comic books and he's an illustrator. He's been one of my favorite artists for a long time. He has a great book called Tongues that he's sending out. And it has a lot to do, I think to some degree, I was probably reading that comic book that is existing on this sort of strange, surreal plane. And I think that sort of started to inform some of the decisions I was making with the stories where you go like, well, why not? Why couldn't this happen? What if you put this up next to that? When I was talking to Jill, who is the editor at A Strange Object, about what we might want to do for the book, that sense of illustration, like that, when I was a kid, I loved illustrations in books. I mean, I just remember staring at the N.C. Wyeth illustrations from Treasure Island, and I love Rockwell Kent, and the ways in which illustrations function not only to, it's they sort of put like a second or like third intelligence into the book. But additionally, they break up the text. And so I was like, let's just get a couple of breathing points in some of these stories, because some of them are long, but let's get some illustrations that are breathing points for folks. And then it also can, to some degree, replicate the stories that you have when you're reading when you're a kid, where you turn the page and then there's sort of a full illustration. You can just kind of linger there for a little bit and it just sends an energy into the book. So we asked Anders and he was game for it and he sent in just the most beautiful illustrations. So the stories were written before the illustrations. So he did illustrate to the stories, but then as soon as I saw the illustrations, I was like, oh, that's it. That's exactly, it really did feel to me. And now that they're in the book, that actually the stories were written around those particular illustrations. Because I write a lot. I cut out pictures and put them up on the wall. And that's generally how I will start a story. There's a story in here called Pools, I Am a Hawk. And that just started because I thought there was a fantastic photograph of a pool in Harper's Magazine. I just cut it out and I was like, well, here we go. Let's see if it works. Huh. And so it was neat to kind of reverse engineer that into this particular book.
What other devices do you use like that? Because I always think that's interesting. I was talking to a writer recently who uses Humans of New York as her character sketches, you know, for her, those are who she bases what her characters look like. And I am kind of always curious about if writers use either newspaper clippings, stories they've heard, or it sounds like you're using pictures from magazines. Are there other things like that that you do to stimulate your imagination?
No, I just sit down and put on music and just start snipping out magazines like I'm going to make a collage to some degree.
Cool.
And then and then something will stick. And then you just kind of run from there. And it gives you sort of a gravity that you're writing towards or sort of the superstructure. And then the whole point becomes you can sort of drop away. So like when you're in some ways, like when you're recording music, you frequently record to what you call like a click track. So the rhythm sort of stays. So nobody gets off track and it's easier to edit later. But then of course it's just like a metronome, but you need it to kind of hit the right beats. And then when the song is over, of course you drop that click track out and you sort of see what's there. And so what I like about writing to a cutout image is that it gives you a whole world that you then start to kind of try to pull under the page, like you're sort of stranding colors out or certain characters. And I think it allows you to think about what's happening outside of the page. And then you just let go of that image and then start paying attention to what the story is actually doing. That's what I've done. I've recently started printing, read this maniac interview with Jesse Ball, who's a great writer and does a lot of this fable stuff actually. And he was talking about, he wrote his first book in, you know, something like 4 days or something like that. But he just printed everything up and just taped it up on the wall. And when I was stuck recently on something and I did it and I was like, oh, this is really great. It's something to make it more physical, to kind of pull it out of the computer. But that's more of an editing trick for me rather than a generative trick, which is writing towards an image.
Yeah, two things you said are resonant. I think Jess Walter did the whole Cold Millions spun out of a postcard image. And so I think there are ways that you can use postcards of old times to, as you say, you know, you start with that and then you just spin out and you're like, what's that little tiny person on the street doing? And I'm going to imagine his whole life. I always liken writing to being thrown in the middle of the ocean as opposed to being thrown into a swimming pool. At least at a swimming pool, you can see an edge to swim towards and, you know, a wall to hold on to or push off from. Whereas, you know, these images probably give you that. Whereas, you know, just tossing yourself in the middle of the ocean is just terrible. You know,
it is. It'll get
it's never
going
to end well. I also love all of your analogies to music. I mean, using music not only as a creative source in the background, but also as a structure. And as you say, as this metronome device. And that I think that's super helpful. And organizing the collection around, you know, like an album with the stories as songs on a bigger track album as a whole, I think is a really useful image and analogy for writing. Do you listen to the music while you're writing it yourself or kind of just during the creative generative process?
While I'm writing, actually. And Ghost Story was written, there was an album called Into the Light by Marissa Anderson, which is this sort of bizarre guitar instrumental. It's almost like the soundtrack to a Western that never actually existed. So it's just the sound, there's no movie or the movie's been lost to time, but the soundtrack is there. And so I find frequently that I use music repetitively with a certain song, with a certain story to kind of do that if you listen to it enough, then when it comes back, when you then revisit the story to edit or to write more and you put on the song, you kind of can plug right back into the emotions. It's as if you sort of left your, whatever it is that you were doing, you kind of left it in the sound space. And when you turn on the music, it's just there and you can kind of grab it and put it back into your work. So I can't listen to music with lyrics while I'm writing, but instrumental music, absolutely. Garth Greenwell is another one of my favorite writers.
Oh,
he's
yeah.
Writing incredible stuff right now. He mentioned that his new collection, Cleanness, he thought of it as a leader cycle, like a song cycle. And what I love about that is that that means that each story is sort of building on the story that came in. You're building a melody and there's sort of musical movement throughout the entire book. So the beginnings and endings of each story, they're not closed. They're just openings and arrivals and openings and arrivals. And then you think of the final piece as somewhat of a summation. And I really like that he was thinking about that with his work.
Maybe we talk a little bit about your publishing path. Ghost Stories, I think, was in Tin House. Yeah. Is that the one?
Yes. Yeah.
So talk a little bit about, you know, when you have a couple of stories that you feel like are done submitting to journals. I mean, you've hit the heavy hitting ones like Plowshares and Tin House, but a little bit about that process and then about your publisher, because I love promoting small presses and some of these places that can do a few unusual things, like including the illustrations with the book. So talk maybe also about finding this publisher and working with them and a bit about that whole businessy side of it.
Let's start with The Strange Object, which is the publisher of the book. I just think they're great. It's run by Jill Myers. It's out of Austin. They're part of Deep Vellum. And what I really wanted to do with this, I wanted to do something different with this book that I wasn't able to do with Peripatetic Coffin. And I really like Peripatetic Coffin, but it felt to some degree like I just didn't feel like I had my hands in that particular book once it left sort of my computer. Mm-hmm. And what I loved about the books that Jill was putting out with Strange Object is, I mean, they're called A Strange Object. And I was like, I want to make a book as an object. I worked for years as a bookseller. I just wanted to try to make something that was just like a great book. And I think that Jill makes great books that are like just physical objects. And so talking to her and working with her through that whole process, that was what we were trying to do this the whole time. So there's the illustrations and the book itself just came through. And I feel really close to this one. And I think it's probably because it is sort of a little bit of a smaller place.
I forget who published Peripatetic Coffin.
It was Echo. Yeah. And they were great. I love the way that book came out. But this book is so much more personal for me that I wanted it to kind of, I don't know, feel a little denser in some way. And I think that they did an amazing job.
Did you find her or she found you? How did that meeting happen?
So Jill Myers used to edit American Short Fiction and she picked up the story Peripatetic Coffin and published it in American Short Fiction. And then it went into the Best American Short Stories that year.
Yeah.
And so we've always kind of been in touch. And when I had this collection together, she was the only person that I really was one to send it to, because I really like her sensibility. And my sense is that with this, people may have been waiting for an incredible novel about environmental cataclysm, but that thing exploded on me. Yeah. And so I think the way that I want to feel about this book is like, if you just work with the people that you really, that you deeply admire and trust, who you think are already doing really cool things, that's the one thing that you can kind of control. You can't control the publicist. You can't control sort of anything else, how the book is received. But you can, to some degree, choose who you work with, and which is why it was so wonderful. It was wonderful to work with Jill, who had, I think, just an, who has an incredible sensibility and really pushed these stories. The reason these stories feel so close to each other, I think, is Jill. She's a great editor. It was also wonderful to have Anders's work in the book as well. I don't know, it just feels nice to have, to be working with so many people that I admire, which isn't to say that I don't admire the people at Echo.
Yeah,
I certainly do. I just didn't know them that well. We were all pretty far away from each other. We sent her the book and she read it really quickly and was really enthusiastic. And I was like, that's it. One of the things that does happen is when you're sort of sending your work out there, at first you kind of think that the only thing you want in the world is a publication, or for someone to, you want a publication in the best magazine, et cetera, et cetera. And you do want that, but this may be sort of growing into being a parent. It means more if it feels like somebody really understands what you're trying to do and appreciates it and can kind of push it into a direction of sort of becoming more of itself. That's just what I felt like doing with this particular book.
Yeah, I think that's so wise, because with few exceptions, no one's going to make a zillion dollars off of books. And so for them to feel close to your heart, as the stories feel close to your heart, it just makes it feel much more authentic and true to what it is trying to be, rather than some commercially glitzy, slick, whatever. I think that's really important. And so many of these small presses are doing such amazing work that I really always like to highlight them. There's so many of them. You know, kind of like the small colleges as opposed to the big name universities. You know, I think there's so many of these small places are doing the important, heartfelt work that don't get enough credit. So I'm glad.
I think so too. And I also think that the way that the publishing sort of structure and the economics have worked out, that it's the small places are the only places that can publish sort of risky work and can take a risk on something just because they love it, without thinking too much about, you know, the pressure from sort of the top, and oh my god, we gave this guy $1 million to, now we really have to sell it. And I only got $500,000 for this book. So
you teach and you have your MFA. Are there kind of writing advice, wisdom, things that you tell your students, or things that have sustained you that we didn't touch on that we should probably highlight for listeners who are writers themselves?
Well, you know, I was just actually listening to your show, and you had a writer on who was saying the thing that he wished that he had known was that it's not going to write itself, and you just have to sit down and do it and dedicate yourself to the work. And I think that that's one of the things that I had to relearn over the course of writing this book, which was you can't wait for that inspiration to strike. You just have to dedicate yourself to it and, you know, make yourself sort of miserable and happy at the same time, but put in the hours. And it seems sort of like a cop-out, but there isn't, I don't think that there, I used to think there was like a magic piece of advice that I could receive from somebody that would tell you how to do this. And the older I get, the less certain about any of this I am. I mean, to some degree, this book for me is about embracing that uncertainty. And it just has more to do with, you just read the work that you really love, read widely, consume things that are challenging in terms of music and literature and film, talk to as many people as you possibly can. While you're doing that, also try to produce work yourself and just be patient with it.
One thing that's helped me recently is a group of like 10 or 12 of us have started Zoom, because we're all stuck in our homes, started Zoom. So we just log in at 9:30 every morning and the cameras go off, the microphones go off, and we sit there until 11:30. And somehow that accountability of just having to sit there and knowing that there are 11 other people sitting there doing the same thing has been transformative. I mean, it really has kept your butt in the chair and, you know, made you feel, even though there's 12 blank squares, you're kind of in it together. You know, to your point about you just have to sit down and do the work. It kind of does make you sit down and do the work. And you can't, you know, it's hard to do much more than 2 hours for me. It's kind of like meditation. You know, I can make it like 7 minutes and then I got to get up and squirm. but
how much more relaxed could I get? What you're mentioning actually just reminded me. I did the exact same thing, and I never used over this pandemic with my students. I never used to write with anybody. I would be so distracted. I was just such a chatterbox. I didn't like being in the same room with people because I just wouldn't get the work done. And I was always jealous of people who would have writing dates and go to a coffee shop and just sit across from each other. But it seemed insane to me. I was like, you just wouldn't get anything done. But during the pandemic, we started doing that with my students because we were all noticing that we were just having a hard time because all we were doing for the rest of our lives was just sitting there kind of thinking about sort of all sorts of
doom.
Or trying really hard to like shut your brain off and doing exactly what you talk about, which is just showing up. No one's chit-chatting and you just go, all right, write for 20 minutes, 25 minutes, surface, 25 minutes. And we did that together. And you're right, it was transformative. It was amazing. And I was really resistant to it. And I kind of thought that what I would do is just pretend I was doing it and I would read it. But then I started to feel really guilty because I was making them do it. And so I did it with them. And it was wonderful. I loved it.
I love the submersion. It all comes back to the submarine with you. I love that. But that's right. If you do it every 25 minutes and you come up, at least you can, if there's a clock, you can, you know, sort of reset yourself and submerge yourself and go back down. I think that's really helpful. And the last thing you said about, or one of the things that I think is important to take from this discussion is your ability and willingness to let things go that aren't working and aren't serving you or aren't serving your interests. And I mean, the biggest example is letting that novel go. And I'm so sorry to hear you talk about it as, you know, a drive of shame or a thumb drive of shame or wherever, because I think there's no shame in that. I mean, I think, you know, pushing ahead on something that just isn't working is, I mean, hopefully something will come of that. I'm sure something will come of that isn't maybe apparent right now, but I do think it's important for writers to know what to let go and what to keep pressing on with. And if it's futile, you know, there's no shame in letting go, I don't think.
Oh, no, I agree with you. And I'm over it now. I'm over it. It's just that sort of moment where you go like, oh man, is this really going to come to nothing? And you're absolutely right. It never comes to nothing because enough time passes and it starts to move in these weird sort of funny ways into the rest of your work. And it's all useful and it's all good time spent. But I actually think, you know, we didn't get a lot of time to talk about how this year has kind of scrambled and rearranged our sense of how you're supposed to make things in during sort of times like this, or what does it mean to make things in the world? But I had a friend of mine sort of say recently, and I've just started to develop, which is like, if it only do the work that's bringing you joy. And which isn't to say like, as soon as it gets hard, you quit, or, you know, being a parent today isn't bringing me joy, but just make sure that, and if that feeling of composition isn't in some way sort of giving you energy, why wouldn't you stop and reshift and think about things in a different way?
Do you feel like you're going to have to be some temporal distance away from what we've been through this year to write about it? Or do you feel like you never want to write about this? Or do you feel like, what has this year done to you creatively?
Well, it's so funny. Like, no, I never want to, I can't even, I know, I don't want to read anything about this year. I mean, it might take years and years and years, but as you were sort of pointing out, and you're not the only one who's mentioned this, that actually these stories actually feel like they were written about this exact moment, the sense of sort of isolation and these pressurized, like the walls are sort of closing in and you can't leave. So to some degree, I feel like I've kind of been in the lockdown of my mind I've been writing about these things for years, and suddenly, oh, you know, here they are.
Right.
It's possible that I will, I don't know. It's really interesting. You mentioned boats, and I just, no matter what, I think that my characters are going to end up on boats. And I will say that over this last year, I felt like our house, which is now just like a filthy house because we've all been living in here, just feels like there were times, particularly over the winter when it was dark and you couldn't see through the windows, and we were all just on top of each other reading books or kind of getting on each other's nerves, it just felt like we were on a boat on some sort of midnight sea, and the trick was just to figure out how to get through it intact. And I think that is something that I've been thinking about for a long time, and it was very weird to suddenly be experiencing it. I think
right.
next time, my next stories are going to be about winning the lottery or something.
Yeah, if you're going to write prophetically, you should write about happy things so we can all go through those instead.
Yeah. I know. Yeah, exactly. An all-you-can-eat buffet. This is perfect.
Right. Well, it is a wonderful collection, and we can find out more about you. You have a website, ethanrutherford.com. I don't know. Are you doing events online and Zoom? I mean, that's one of the nice things. I feel so sorry for authors releasing books during the pandemic, but also I've never attended more author events probably in any other year than I've been able to do this year, because I just zoom in and out of all of them. So I don't know if you're able to do a lot of those for this book.
Yeah, I totally agree. That has been one of the nice things. You sort of, and you can sit there and you can drink like 10 beers at the same time.
Right. Yes. You can turn your camera off and just get drunk. Yeah. Right.
Nobody can see it. But suddenly you have access and you hear your favorite writers talking, and you could never, nobody comes through here. And so I used to live in New York, and you could go to readings all the time. And that has been missing from my life. But now suddenly there's all these amazing events that are happening, and we've all kind of gotten over our resistant. We just kind of submitted to the Zoom sphere.
Right.
And you just get used to it, and there's these wonderful things. I'm doing a couple of events. I'm doing a couple of launch events. I am doing them online, but not too many. I really love, what I miss is going into, I worked at bookstores. I miss going into bookstores. I miss standing around books. And when you would give a reading, particularly in smaller places, it felt like you were talking to other books, which is kind of what I've always thought about what it means to write, is that you're trying to be in conversation with these objects, these other objects that you've loved, and you're just pleased to be on the shelf with them. And so I like Zoom, but it doesn't have that same feeling for me.
No, I agree with you. The one thing I do like is being able to see, especially in author interviews, being able to see where the magic happens, to be able to see inside these writers' offices,
yes,
see what they have on their walls and what's on their bookshelves. And I'm always like, you know, zooming in, physically zooming in on their bookshelves to see what's up there, you know, to see.
Yes.
So that part's kind of fun. But
I do the same thing too. And I'm just like, oh, no one's house is like as dirty as mine right now. So wait, but everyone, of course, you know, right outside of the frame, I'm sure there's, you know, all those things.
Total chaos. Yes, I'm sure.
That's so funny. I do the exact same thing. And you go, oh, that person has a really good Zoom setup. They must be doing a lot of these. And then you have other people who are reading like into their cell phone, and you go like, well,
right. Then you have me in my master bedroom closet. Yeah. So.
Yeah.
Well, Ethan Rutherford, this was such a pleasure. Thanks so much for taking the time today. This was great.
Thank you so much for having me on again.
That's all the time we have for today. You have been listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining me. Have a great day.